Hello, I'm Paul Hood. I'm going to present today my article on From the School of Hard Knocks, Thoughts on the Initial Estate Planning Interview. Why this subject? Why the title? I'll take the second question first. From the School of Hard Knocks, Thoughts on the Initial Estate Planning Interview. When I first started estate planning, I was drafting from partners' memos. However, when I started having to interview my own clients, I realized that I wasn't really trained to do that in law school. I didn't pick up any of that training along the way in practice. In fact, I learned from the School of Hard Knocks how to ask a question, what to ask, what not to ask, when to ask a question, and when to avoid an area like the plague. What I want you to do is I want you to start out by looking at the diagram at the end of your materials. It should be right before my feeble attempt at a humorous bio. And it's entitled, Why is a good estate planning result so hard to achieve? Notice that the client, advisors, and loved ones, intended beneficiaries, and others all have the issues on the top of the big arrows, and these issues run both ways: prior inheritance experience, attitudes toward death, relations, mental and physical health, siblings, parents, attitudes toward wealth, other life experiences, and even personality type. Notice that the client has certain issues that are unique to the client. Advisors have issues unique to them. And the same is true for loved ones, intended beneficiaries, and others. You have to navigate those rather choppy waters before you get to a good estate planning result. I maintain that every time a good estate planning result is achieved, we ought to celebrate. We certainly know when a bad estate planning result is achieved, but I maintain that a good one is worthy of celebration. When I started to deconstruct the area of the initial estate planning interview, I realized how little had been written on interviewing in the law. There is a nutshell in the West series called Legal Interviewing by Tom Schaefer from the Notre Dame Law School, who has probably single-handedly written more about legal interviewing than anyone else, and it hasn't been much. So I turned to another helping profession, the area of psychologists and psychiatrists. And as I started doing some research to learn about interviewing skills to enhance my own, I realized that this group, these professionals, these helping professionals, claim that interviewing is a very, very important skill and one that can be taught. Let me say before going further, a disclaimer. I don't claim to have all the answers or even all the questions. If I seem absolutely certain of my position, please remember that I'm not as certain as I seem. However, I wrote this article, which was eventually published in the ACTech Journal back in 2002, in order to trumpet a Baconian call for further analysis by estate planners of the human processes of estate planning. I maintain that soft knowledge is the mortar of estate planning. It is what keeps the techniques and tools of estate planning, which I'll refer to as the bricks, together. Soft knowledge can be crucial in estate planning. I realized that there are some parallels between what estate planners do in an initial interview and what doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists do in their initial interviews. Now, granted, they're going to different ends, but we have to figure out the lay of the land. Both of us have to figure out what condition the client's in. Financial condition, health condition, all these sorts of questions. And it's very, very important that we get this information, get it in an economic period of time, and get it right. So both of us have the same goal in mind. And as I started reading books on medical interviewing, I started seeing things that looked very, very familiar. And in fact, so familiar that it was scary to read, and you'll see some of the quotes that I have included in this article. Unlike doctors and psychiatrists, however, we get, and I'm speaking of my subspecialty, law, little to no training in interviewing except for fact finders. Now, every firm has a fact finder, and if you stick to that, you might can get enough information to fill in a legal document, but maybe not enough information to make a good estate planning result. In a poll of medical providers, out of 32 skill sets, comprehensive interviewing was number one. And I would think that we ought to ascribe a similar importance to legal interviewing. The good news is that interviewing techniques can be learned and taught. And one of my purposes of this article was to get some information out there for people who wanted to read about legal interviewing, especially estate planning initial interviews, to go ahead and allow them to do that. Now, I want you to the back of the materials, pages 28 and 29. And I call these two pages the minds of the estate planner and the client during the initial interview. A meeting of the minds or two ships passing in the night. Notice what goes through the estate planner's mind. Am I physically safe with this client? I mean, these are questions that have tended to pop up in my mind. I know when I was with a law firm and I met with clients during office hours in a big building, I very seldom worried about safety. I'm 6'5", 250 pounds. However, when I became a sole practitioner and met with clients after hours or at their homes or whatnot, occasionally the idea of safety did cross my mind. Will this person make me uncomfortable? And if you go through some of these questions, you will find things that you may have thought about. Will this client be willing to pay the reasonable fees for the work that I perform? How likely is it that this person will sue me or attempt to drag me into a fight? Will the client be pleased with my work or with the work of any advisor? Can I expand my services with this client into other needs? How likely is it that this client will refer me to other friends or relatives? How much TLC or hand-holding will this client expect or require? Clients vary dramatically in this. Now, I want you to take a quick turn to what goes through the client's mind. In performing the research for this paper, I actually asked my clients individually what went through their mind when we met the first time. And the first question is, can this person help me? That was the very, very first question that came out of everyone's mouth. Will I be able to work with this person? Am I physically safe with this person? Will this person make me feel uncomfortable? Is this person going to be loyal to me? So these are very, very important questions. And as you're sitting, just imagine the balloon out of the, it's like the old cartoon balloon thought. This is the balloon thoughts of the client, and the page 28 of the balloon thoughts of the estate planner. Now, turn ahead, go back to the beginning of the materials and turn ahead to page 7. This is from a book called Psychiatric Interviewing, and it's in the preface to the first edition. The initial psychiatric interview is a creative act. It is a study of movement and change. It is unique. The circumstances, the environment, and the people involved can never be duplicated. Even if the interviewer or interviewee wanted to replicate their own interaction, they could not. For with each sentence, their interaction has subtly changed. This creativity is harnessed by two pivotal principles. The patient must be powerfully engaged, and a thorough, valid, database must be gathered in a limited period of time. These two principles form the basis of the initial therapeutic encounter. They represent a complementary pair. When performed with sensitivity through thorough data gathering, mirrors effective engagement. This applies to estate planners very, very easily. With each question that you ask, you can turn a meeting around. With each comment that you make, you might turn a meeting south. I mean, the initial estate planning interview is a very, very delicate interaction, and it is one that is a study of movement and change, and it is unique as well. On page 8, I go into the role and importance of listening generally. And listening, what I mean by listening is to be really, really reflective listening. Listening is also a skill. It's a skill that many lawyers do not have. Listening, I can tell you what listening is not. Listening is not simply giving someone else a turn to speak while you're thinking of what to say to rebut what that person is saying. That is not listening. Listening isn't easy. If you turn to page 9, genuine listening involves a brief suspension of self. You won't always notice this because it's reflexive and taken for granted. And because in most conversations, we take turns, but you might catch yourself rehearsing what you're going to say next when the other person is talking. Simply holding your tongue while the other person speaks isn't the same as listening. To really listen, you have to suspend your own agenda, forget about what you say next, and concentrate on being a receptive vehicle for the other person. This is very, very important. And in estate planning particularly, because if you're not listening, you may pick up enough through your experience to say the client is heading in this direction, and then you plug in the tape in your mind that you make a presentation on that isn't responsive to what the client really wanted had you heard them correctly. So that's a very, very important skill. And again, The Lost Art of Listening is the book that came out of, and it's a very, very important skill, that of listening. There are a number of books on listening. Listening is mostly nonverbal, so if you spend your time simply looking at your pad or your fact finder and not looking at the client's body language, there are research studies that indicate that body language can be up to 95% of what is being communicated. So it's very, very important to read the client. This is true particularly in estate planning, where you might pick up disagreements, for example, between husband and wife that are being subtly communicated. On page 10, what do clients really want from us initially? You may be surprised. As I indicated in the first paragraph, we believe that when a client comes into our office and starts the meter running, they want our advice, our brilliant advice, immediately. And we, of course, want to waste no time showing them how smart we really are. However, if you take a look at the quote in the middle of the page, when the people I know talk about feelings, what's really on their minds, what they're excited about, what's troubling them, they want to be listened to and acknowledged, not interrupted with advice or told that someone else had a similar experience. They want listeners who will take the time to listen and acknowledge what they're saying, not immediately turn the focus to themselves. Estate planners can be very, very guilty of this. I know I've been guilty of it in the past, where I've had a similar experience. I impart that, but it simply is turning the focus to me instead of where the focus ought to be, which is on the client. On page 11, the second quote on the page, it isn't that we're bad listeners. It's our hidden emotional agenda that crowds out our understanding and concern. Then the next line is taken from an estate planning rap song that I actually have written and have delivered on numerous occasions. Performances are available on request. Too much showing, way too much telling, not enough listening, not enough counseling. So that's counseling in the rap parlance. The next question that most estate planners ask at this point is, okay, Hood, you've told us that listening is a skill. You've told us that interviewing is a skill. You've told us that clients may not want our advice immediately. Where do we go from here? And the next logical question, if you look at the quote, is how does one convey expertise effectively during an initial interview? The answer lies primarily not in what we tell the patient, but in what we ask the patient. It is the quality of our questions, not the quantity of our words, that generally convinces a patient that the clinician knows something that might help. And that is a very, very important fact. We, as estate planners, always want to demonstrate how up we are on the latest and greatest estate planning tools and techniques. But this isn't where the client is. And too often we believe that's where the client is. But that's not where they usually are. So we have to keep that in mind. I asked on page 12, does technology in estate planning have a downside? Are we shutting out part of the communication? This is a very, very valid question, because as estate planning tools and techniques are easier to explain on PowerPoint presentations and through various other computer programs, it can be very devilishly enticing to shirk part of the interview duties and simply become sort of a technician acting behind the curtain, if you will, while you put on your dog and pony show for the client. This is a very, very important aspect of the initial client interview. Now, if you look on page 13, the advisor and the initial interview generally, we have to realize that no matter how strong our efforts are to the contrary, we bring emotional baggage into an estate planning interview. We bring our past in. We bring current physical condition into the interview. This is why, for a great many reasons, I only schedule interviews on certain days and at certain times, simply because if it's feasible, simply because I know that's when I'm at my strongest. I tend to like morning interviews because I'm at my best during the mornings. After lunch, I get rather sleepy and grumpy, and maybe I won't listen as well. So we have to remember that we bring our own baggage. I mean, some of us are divorced and have a certain feeling about marriage in general, and that can impact how we advise clients based upon our prior experiences. It can go down to little subtle things like, I mean, for example, I'll tell one on myself. I'm a firstborn child, so I automatically often default to the oldest child as a successor, executor, or trustee without discussing it with the client. I've got no business doing that, but that's a built-in bias of mine that I have to really, really watch out for. So it's very, very important that we do that. Turn to page 15, because this is a very, very critical point. Have you ever had a situation where you met with a client, you thought you got on very well, and the client never comes back? Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me. And I tried to figure out why, even after I would follow up. Take a look at the quote on page 15, the first quote. More specifically, poor engagement raises significant doubts about the validity of the database, for patients generally do not freely share with people they do not like. Hence, the clinician leaves with only a superficial understanding of the patient's pain. Furthermore, without valid data falling into place, the clinician's assessment and diagnosis are frequently in significant jeopardy. Finally, if the engagement process proceeds poorly, the patient may never return for a second appointment, casting the shadow of irrelevance over the work of the first interview. This is a concept called unipolar blending, where you blended with the client, but the client didn't blend with you. And it happens without any fault of our own. I mean, you know, unless we just aren't good listeners or we said something wrong, or in some cases the client really wasn't in a strong enough place psychologically to do the estate planning interview at that time. And maybe they weren't ready for estate planning in general. On the bottom of page 15, we get into the estate planner and the data gathering process. The first quote really knocked me over. Thus, it is not only a matter of gathering data, it is a question of realizing that one alters the database by the very act of gathering the data. One alters the database by the very act of gathering the data. Take a look at your fact finder. You may find biases there, and it's very important to retool and look at your fact finders. Those are things that don't tend to get looked at very often, or certainly not as often as your forms do. The second quote on the page, interviewers may not want to hear positive responses to questions concerning sensitive topics such as suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, child abuse, or even the emergence of certain target symptoms such as depression. The hesitancy to uncover positive replies to such questions probably results from the fact that such responses may demand increased time from the clinician or legal action, or even generate fear or a sense of failure in the clinician. Consequently, clinicians may unconsciously develop methods of decreasing the risk of a positive reply by beginning their questions with a negative, such as, "You don't really feel more depressed, do you?" Many of the questions therapists ask are really opinions disguised as questions. Now, in estate planning, you don't really want a living trust, do you? You don't really want a family limited partnership, do you? We can ask the same sorts of questions, especially if it's in an area that we're not comfortable in. If you take a look at page 17, the first quote, patients are very quick to perceive defensiveness in an interviewer. Defensive posturing by the clinician may create in the interviewee the feeling that I've got to watch what I say here. The issue of interviewer reliability can be framed within two problem areas, although many other areas also exist. The interviewer changes his or her style of asking a question and is not aware of the impact of this change. And two, the interviewer has good reliability, but unfortunately reliably evokes invalid information. How many times have you had clients omit significant assets in the estate planning process? I will tell you that in an informal survey of numerous, more than I can count on, crowds of laymen, when I ask the question, have you ever significantly misstated your financial information to a financial advisor or an estate planner, more than 3/4 of the audience raise their hand. Now, what are some of the reasons for this? Some of the reasons for this may be don't want this person to know the whole picture, want to ease my way into this person's circle. But you just have to realize that this is a real possibility, and we have to be ready for it. Now, indirect data gathering and interpretation problems, and this is on page 18. I posit that all would agree that the prospects for malpractice grow in the areas of misinterpretation of data when I introduce another professional of the office into the mix. Whether we like it or not, once we have someone else in the office on the file, we've got the potential for miscommunication. It's now a three-way triangular relationship. Things can get tossed up and down in that area unless we're very, very careful. So that's something to always think about whenever you're designing your initial estate planning interview forms, so that things are clear and it's not subject to misinterpretation by someone else in your office. Page 19, I start into the importance of honest, objective self-evaluation by estate planners. Have you ever considered at what time of day you are at your best in the way of listening, mornings or afternoons, as well as the days you're really more attentive? I thought long and hard about this and realized that I am a far better listener in the morning. I don't listen well on Mondays. I prefer to meet with clients on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday mornings. I have to have some time for drafting, and drafting in the afternoon makes an easier task for me. It suits my style. Not everyone is the same. What is your style? Find it and go with it, because I think it's very, very important. You have to self-examine yourself. This is very important as well. Listening to yourself means not only respecting your own feelings, but also getting to know something about your own ways of communicating. This isn't always easy, and it isn't always pleasant. Anytime we examine our own selves, we may not like what we find. I know that whenever I've examined myself, I find that I fall short in a number of categories that I really wish I was better at. However, I'm dealing with me, and I have to do the best that I can to compensate for my shortcomings. I can do things to compensate for my shortcomings if I realize what my shortcomings are. However, if you've never thought about what your shortcomings are, and most people have never thought about it, you run the risk of running right through one of your shortcomings and having it negatively impact your particular estate planning practice. So self-introspection is very, very important. Look at the quote at the bottom of page 19. But the real problem in that first interview didn't have to do with technique. I wasn't truly interested in that woman. I was more interested in being a therapist. The same can be said for estate planning. Quite often, we don't want to get wrapped up into the personal problems of our clients. And in estate planning, we get into a number of personal problems. They come with the territory, whether we like it or not. And we just have to understand that. I was really blown away by this quote because I could see situations where, particularly when I was a younger lawyer, I was really wanting to do that grat or do that family partnership. I mean, these were things that I wanted to do, and I needed to spend time truly listening to the clients and thinking about that other stuff later. It gets into a suspension of self. It also gets into a skill set of listening that we all really, really must develop. Believe it or not, some estate planners have a subconscious agenda, and we have to be introspective enough to determine whether we're in that group of folks, because we certainly can be. We're forced to consider the possibility that, similar to what a philosopher Alvin W. Guldner argued concerning the intellectual class, estate planners, being the intellectual elite in wealth, may have our own agendas, and that is something to really, really keep in mind. We may have strong biases, for example, in favor of charitable planning. We may have strong biases against certain types of estate planning. We bring our personal baggage into the estate planning initial interview. And the more that we realize that we do this, the less likely that our own personal baggage will get in the way. We don't want to trip over our own baggage. And that's one of the main purposes of this article. If you look at the quote on page 20, that failures of understanding occur in psychotherapy just as in everywhere else, is a fact often missed as long as therapists remain too wrapped up in their own theories and techniques and intentions to give themselves over to sustained immersion in the other person. This quote could be lifted and put into an estate planning initial interview text, and no one would ever know where it came from. This fits exactly. And so many of these quotes, the reason why these quotes are here, my purpose in writing the article the way that I did, was to show how similar the initial interviews were in all the helping professions. I consider estate planning to be a helping profession. I consider social work, psychology, psychiatry, therapeutic psychiatry to all be helping professions, medicine. These are helping professions, and they have some similarities. And I think the initial estate planning interview is one area where they have significant similarities. But that quote was really, really right on the money. Quite often we put on airs. I mean, I know estate planners who will refuse to meet with a client except in their offices, behind their desk. In other words, in their conference room of choice, where they occupy a position of comfort. I meet with clients primarily in their homes or in their offices. So I got over that a long time ago. But some of us haven't. And we have those that issue. We tend to put on airs as estate planners, particularly lawyers. Lawyers are the worst at this. I like the quote at the top of page 21. In the final analysis, the mark of a true professional seems to be his or her lack of a need to feign professionalism. I mean, that is really, really critical. Let's get to the client and others in the interview process. And I'm on page 22. Look at this first quote. I mean, this just really, really sums it up. In order to explain the concept of clinician experience most effectively, it may be best temporarily to view the interviewing process solely from the patient's perspective. To the patient, certain questions are of paramount importance. The answer to one of these questions in particular holds unusually powerful significance, perhaps even determining the degree of final compliance. It is a logical question. It is a natural question. And it can be paraphrased simply as follows. Can this person help me? Now, the best thing that I did for myself as a lawyer was to become a client. As the trustee of a trust, a large trust that had to hire lots and lots of lawyers, I found myself disliking the techniques of certain of our lawyers. I found that I was aggravated when clients didn't return my calls. I mean, not when clients, when my lawyers didn't return my calls promptly. When promises were made and then broken. One of the best things you can do for yourself, the best gift you can give yourself, is to be a client, because you will never see things from your side of the table again the same way. For a while there, I spent a fair amount of my time as a client, and it's a very, very good thing to do. Look at the quote, the second quote on page 22. More specifically, one can categorize patients with some degree of caution into two types, those who are trusting and those who feel guarded. It is with the latter patient, the so-called guarded patient, that empathic statements most frequently display the nasty habit of disrupting the engagement process. The guarded quality of those patients may arise from a variety of sources, including a fear of the clinician, a long-standing character trait of suspiciousness, or frankly, pre-psychotic or psychotic paranoia. Now, we don't get into the paranoid thing, although we may be dealing with paranoid people. And that's one of the things, as estate planners, that we have to understand. We may also be dealing with people who have some either personality disorders or deal with depression or bipolar disorders or whatnot. And even though we don't have to be trained to deal with that, sometimes it impacts how we do something, when we do it, and all that kind of thing. I think we can categorize clients into the same types of categories. Those who are trusting, those who volunteer and give us all the information, and those who are guarded, who either withhold information or only give it when it's specifically asked for. One of the things that you have to understand in estate planning is that in the interview process, you're going to be interviewing some clients that you will not be liking. Every one of our clients doesn't like us, and we don't like every one of our clients. It's simply a fact of life. However, we cannot allow the fact that we dislike a client to impact how we represent that client. And if you look at the quote on page 23, whenever someone asks your advice or shrinks from you or gets impatient with you, it's worthwhile to think about what parts of the person might be at war with each other. Internal things can be going on in the client, but I maintain that internal things can be going on inside the estate planner as well. And it's very, very critical that we realize that this kind of thing may be going on. Perhaps the client reminds you of someone that you don't like. This is a concept called countertransference in psychological terms. When a client gets angry at you during an estate planning meeting, the client may well not be angry at you. It may be angry at someone else, but is transferring that anger to you. That is the concept known as transference in psychological terms. In estate planning, whether we like it or not, whether we recognize it or not, we run into a lot, a heck of a lot, of transference and countertransference. So it's very, very important. I get into this in the section of the paper on page 24 called Triangles in Estate Planning. A triangular relationship is where three people or more are involved. And you've heard about and remember as kids when two would gang up on one. A three-person relationship changes a lot. And there's been quite a bit written about estate planning, not about estate planning triangles, but about triangular relationships in general. In fact, I cite you to a book, a very well-written book, on relationship triangles that was put out by the Guildford Press. This is a very, very important thing to remember, because you may have a triangular relationship between a parent, child, and yourself. You may have a triangular relationship between parent, parents, spouse, and yourself. Triangles I have even seen happen between, including dead people. People who are upset with their father for doing in his estate planning what they didn't want him to do. You see people who are not around brought into triangles. You see it in family names given to children, bedrooms or other items given to children, school-selected sports, their realities in estate in relationships, and estate planners must be at least aware that they exist. One of the most daunting tasks that an estate planner can undertake is an intergenerational meeting of a family. When you walk into a room by yourself with two, maybe three generations of family members being present, everybody eyeing you for the first time, what's going through people's minds is, will this person be my friend or my foe? At some point, that's going to go through the mind of every single one of those people, especially if you're coming in to do some business succession planning or things like that. Take a look on page 26 at the expert paradox. We saddle ourselves with the mantle of expert. We pride ourselves in being experts. We love to be known as experts, and this is true of human beings in general. But watch out for this. And if you take a look at the quote on page 26, people who insist the doctor or therapist is the expert and should be telling them what creates the problem must be addressed at the outset. If a therapist falls into the trap of being set up as an expert, who can tell the family what its problem is and what is needed to fix it? He may be forever prescribing techniques for change. Some families are in conflict. Some families are stuck in conflict. And it's very, very important to leave your ego at the door and deal with the situation that you have. And I think it's very, very important to keep your eye on the ball and to check that ego at the door. If you take a look at the quote on page 27, the processes by which a family's anxiety and subjectivity can brainwash a family are sufficiently subtle that most therapists require years of clinical experience to recognize them fully. Experience alone, however, guarantees nothing. A therapist can be in practice for years and never realize he is often a pawn of the families he treats, or that the families he treats are often pawns of what is needed to make him feel comfortable. Psychoanalytic training addresses this problem by requiring analysts to have personal analysis. Now, lawyers don't have to have their own therapy. Sometimes it would be worthwhile to consider it, because we get a lot of baggage laid off on us. Some lawyers react to it well. Some lawyers self-medicate. It's very critical that we know where we are at any particular point in time to have a good basis for where we are, to be able to listen to the client, so that we know where they are, so that we can give them good advice. We're just about to wrap up. I wanted to point out a couple of more things in the few minutes that I have left, because I was told to. If you find yourself, and I'm on page 14, being bored, angry, or disgusted, ask yourself why. Is there someone this patient reminds you of, such as a supervisor, parent, or spouse? When therapist feelings toward patients are carried over from previous relationships of their own, it is called countertransference. And I think it's very, very important to keep that in mind. I want to underscore the quote on page 19, the second quote, but the real problem in that first interview didn't have to do with technique. I wasn't truly interested in that woman. I was more interested in being a therapist. That is very, very well said. If we get too interested in being an estate planner and not interested enough in solving the client's problem, we can run into into that very, very same situation. I think in closing, I just simply want to point out that things go through our mind during an estate planning interview. Things go through the client's mind during an estate planning interview. We have to be aware of this. All the while, we have to be listening ever attentively to the client so that we get a good data set so that we perform the best work that we can.